Good afternoon. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. And I just love Larsine. She's one of my favorite people in the world. Now, she said she's not an authority on Al-Anon. It's a very nice thing to say. She doesn't really believe that, but it's a very nice thing to say. But I've told her this before, too. Due to the nature of my work, it's very often that there is my office is in a men's recovery home, and so quite often there's mothers or wives whose husbands or son have just gone into the place, and they are talk, telling me all the reasons why, you know, it's not their fault or it is their fault or whatever they're saying. And I always recommend Al-Anon, but I say, before you go to the meeting, and I reach in my desk and I hand them a CD of Larsine. Say, listen to this and then give me a call with all your questions. Anyway, she was right about this. I was sort of balking at the relationship seminar just simply because she's been married since I was 12, for God's sake. And I've been drunk and sober, a phenomenal failure in the relationship area. So I was balking at that. My girlfriend Kelly is with me, and so that was a kind of a touchy thing. But our relationship is going to be over after this trip because she skunked me at ping pong, and I can't operate in those circumstances. But what I can tell you, here's an example of what a failure, drunk and sober, I am in relationships. I got sober in the Navy. I was newly sober and talking with some fellows. I don't know, we were up in somewhere in Canada or something. The ship was in Canada. I'm sitting at a coffee shop with some fellows. They're discussing turning to lower companions, right? And so I chime in and say, oh, I really identify this turning to lower companions thing. I start to describe that in the last 7 months of my drinking, the military had me on Anabuse. I did not balk at it like Butch did. It just made my drinking a little bit more colorful, is what it did. And I started to describe that I used to lock myself in this hotel room in downtown San Diego, and I'd have to go through like an hour and a half of drinking and puking and drinking and puking so I could just be red-faced and hyperventilate, and I was okay with that. And I would always be in room number 11 in this Plaza Hotel. And in room number 10, there was a nickel and dime crack dealer. And sailors would be coming and going and coming and going out of that room. I'm barking and puking on Anabuse in the next door. And in the other room, there was a pregnant hooker. And sailors were coming and going and coming and going and coming and going. And that after that, I was done puking and barking and puking and drinking, and he was done with his business, and she apparently was done with her business, we would party together. And so I was describing, oh, this is what I mean, that, you know, turning to lower companions. And these fellows, they don't let you get away with a thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. They go, and you were in the Navy. And I go, yes. And you were like AWOL from your ship in order to accomplish this, correct? And I go, well, yeah. I mean, this was a 2 or 3 day event here. And they go, I'm sorry, Carl, but they were not your lower companion. You were theirs because at least they could show up at work. Right? But what I can tell you about what I'm doing in my life in that area is I got divorced about three years ago. I have two little kids. In my relationship area, there are two things that I am consciously very, very aware of that I need to be doing on a daily basis. I need to be the best father that I can possibly be. And I need to be the best ex-husband I can possibly be and be a partner with my ex-wife in raising those kids. Those are the things that I consciously take actions in my life pretty much every single day. And that's what I'm doing in my life. What I would like to do is to go over a little portion of chapter 5. We've been reading it every single meeting that I've been at this conference, except this one. And I like to discuss what it says in chapter 5 in the first few pages that we read at, because apparently it must be very important, because they read it at just about every single meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous around the world. There is, obviously it's become a custom that it's very, very, I believe the reason they've decided to start reading this portion of chapter 5 in just about every single meeting is simply to take the stress off of the home group members. In case nothing else of any value gets said at that meeting, at least a new person will hear what Alcoholics Anonymous is and is not. So it sort of takes the pressure off you. So if your home group is not reading this portion of chapter 5, I strongly suggest you do. Otherwise, the whole responsibility of what that new person hears is on you. Right? So if it's, and I don't know about you, but sitting at my home group is a 6:15 attitude adjustment meeting in Covina, California. At 6:15 in the morning, we have anywhere from, 70 to 120 people at that meeting every single morning. And we do the third step prayer at the beginning, the seventh step prayer at the end, and we read chapter 5 at every single meeting. And I don't know about you, but quite often I daydream during chapter 5. I have been sober 24 years, and I would say I have heard chapter 5 read close to 3,000 times. And sometimes somebody is reading it, and I hear it in a way that I have never heard it before. I imagine that has happened to you before also, where you just go, but the other seven times in that week that you heard it, you just kind of, you sit, if you're like me, they say, rarely we see any person fail, and my mind goes, oh, look, there's my sponsor. I love my sponsor. Why is he talking to that chronic relapser again? God, again. The guy's not going to get, that's why he's my sponsor, because he does that. Oh, that's right. Or wander around, looking around. What's he doing here? Is she with him? Do you have a mind like that that just sort of wanders around the room, and then all of a sudden they say, God couldn't, would have, sought, and you go, all right. So, but apparently it's really important what they read in this first portion of chapter 5. So let's see what it is that Alcoholics Anonymous is trying to say to the brand new person in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Huge statement. Huge statement. If you're brand new, sitting in the back, you haven't even talked to anybody, you're at a big meeting, and you don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, right there they have said a very huge statement. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I imagine the new person, if they are even conscious, would go, what's their path? What's their path? And of course, if you ask about 10 different alcoholics in any room, they would give you 10 different answers. What's our path? Oh, it's the steps. Oh, and it's meetings. No, it's working with others. No, it's having a sponsor. Well, it's all of the above. It's our way of life. It's our way of life. If you thoroughly follow our way of life, that's being on the path. I like to correlate that to, if you know the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know that a man named Roland Hazard, prior to Bill and Bob getting sober, the book likes to refer to him as a certain American businessman. They're being kind of nice. He's really like the rich, drunk kid of a very wealthy family, right? And they're trying to get him sober, and they send him over under the care of Dr. Carl Jung. After a year of therapy, Carl Jung says, you've done some amazing work. I think that you should be able to be okay. Roland Hazard is drunk before he gets on the ship back to New York, right? You can imagine the family after a year with the most world-renowned psychologist. Oh, my God, he's drunk again. And so Roland goes back to Carl Jung, and Carl Jung says a very important thing. I misdiagnosed you. Apparently you're a chronic alcoholic, and I have never seen one single case recover where that state of mind exists as it apparently does in you. And of course that crushed Roland. Roland had some hope of being able to get his life straightened out, and Roland goes, but are there no exceptions, doctor? And Carl Jung said, well, I have heard, I've never personally seen, but I have heard that here and there have been these vital spiritual experiences, these overwhelming rearrangement of ideas. I don't understand them. They are phenomena. And I don't know how to produce that. I don't know how to reproduce that. I don't know how to get it to be produced in you, but I've heard about it. So what he's describing that is that over the centuries of mankind, ever since mankind accidentally dropped a grape, stepped on it, left it there for a week, and then licked it up and went, whoa, right? We've had alcohol. Ever since early days, Every once in a while in a congregation or some sort of community meeting, somebody, some drunk went, "Pah! I'm sober." And the whole community or congregation would go, "Oh my God, you are. Tell us how you did that. My husband is dying. My daughter is dying. Please tell us, how'd you do that?" And they would go, "I don't know. I don't know." So, of course, the community go, "Well, lots of good you are, right? But they're sober, but they don't know how it happened, so they can't help anybody." I propose to you that what Alcoholics Anonymous is, and our path, is that Alcoholics Anonymous has been able to mass-produce spiritual awakenings of that type that used to happen, you know, prior to 75 years ago, once in a while, here and there, and they were unexplained. We have learned how to mass produce those. In the same way that prior to Henry Ford and the production line, only the few could afford an automobile. And you didn't just have to be wealthy, you had to be super wealthy. But when Henry Ford came up with mass production and the assembly line, then every common person could have a car. And our path is kind of like our assembly line. You can't see it in here, but we have one. It's kind of a conveyor belt right down through the middle of the room. We take a new person, we put them on the conveyor belt. We give them a sponsor, we give them a big book, we teach them how to work steps, and then we teach them how to work with others. And at the end, just like at the end of the conveyor belt, you would have a guaranteed a Model T Ford, at the end, we guarantee you, you will have a spiritual awakening of the type that is necessary to overcome alcoholism. Right? It is guaranteed. You are going to have that if you stay on the conveyor belt. The problem is, most people don't stay on the conveyor belt. They jump off the conveyor belt, point at the people still on it, and make fun of us. That's usually what happens. Now, here's the category of those. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves the simple program. First thing that scares a lot of people, completely give themselves a simple program. Oh my God, it's a cult. Right? That's what new people think often. It's a cult. Right? We can disprove that in 2 seconds. A cult asks you, get rid of all of your worldly possessions and come in here and do not communicate with the people that love you anymore. Well, it's actually the opposite. We in Alcoholics Anonymous, we know you don't have a goddamn thing worth a penny. And we're going to tell you to come in here and we will teach you how to communicate with the people that love you. Right? It's exactly the opposite, so it's silly. But the other thing is that if I've been relapsing and not being successful in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have to ask myself a very important question. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves a simple program. So I got to ask myself, which category am I? Am I a cannot or am I a will not? And 99.9% of the time, if we're honest with ourselves, we are a will not. And here's the danger of people that come and go and come and go and come and go out in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the same way that if you ever take any classes on alcoholism, you learn about how we build up an immunity or a tolerance to alcohol, we can actually build up an immunity and a tolerance to Alcoholics Anonymous when we come and go and come and go and come and go. Those little magic band-aids that are thrown onto our alcoholism prior to us working the steps no longer have the same effect. Here's an example. Let's say we had two fellows sitting over there in a meeting. One of them has both of them have 4 days. One of them has never been to Alcoholics Anonymous before, and the other one has been coming and going for 10 years. And the old timer in the meeting says, if you don't take the first drink, you can't get drunk. The guy who has never been to AA before, has 4 days, jumps to attention. Did you hear that? Oh my God, did you hear that? You see the guy later that day smoking out in front of the AA club go, if I don't take the first drink, I can't get drunk. Did you know that? Right? He has a minor spiritual awakening. This is life-changing news to him. Right? Just a little warning. If you hear those little things like that in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're fairly new, don't call your non-alcoholic relatives that love you and try to impress them with what you're learning in AA. I remember the first time I heard that, I called my mom. And I said, Mom, you wouldn't believe what I heard in the meeting of AA. I said, they told me if I don't take the first drink, I can't get drunk. There was silence on the other end of the line. After about 10 seconds, she said, bunch of philosophers there in that AA program, huh? Right? But this guy who's brand new, he absolutely has a minor spiritual awakening. He says, whoa! Did you hear that? Stay sober for 4 days just thinking about that. The other guy, who also has 4 days, but has been coming and going, old-timer says, if you don't take the first drink, you can't get drunk. Flatline, no response at all. Absolutely, just thinks, anybody got a smoke? I'm going outside. Right? No response. So we can build up an immunity to what we're hearing in Alcoholics Anonymous. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. This sometimes can confuse the new person. They think that we are saying, if you don't get rigorously honest in all areas of your life, you're not going to make it. And that's scary, because if that was true, none of us would be sitting here. I wouldn't be, if I had to be honest across the board right when I got here. What they are referring to is rigorously honest about my alcoholism. It's going to be a long road for me in getting honest in other areas of my life. Here's an example. This actually has a little example of my relationship successes in it. I'm completely delusional about who I was, and I didn't even know how delusional I was. I was must have been 4 months sober, and I was dating this girl. She had 4 years sober. Apparently, she was 13 stepping me. It was just horrible, I tell you. I still remember the first night I met her. She was at a meeting and sitting about four people down from me, and she looked at me, and I looked at her, and she smiled, and I just thought God had put her in my life. Really, I mean, we have all this in common. She's alcoholic, I'm alcoholic. What are the odds in an AA meeting? You know? So I run out to my first sponsor, Bob, another guy on my shift, and he's out there with some of his friends, and I run out to tell Bob that I'd met this girl and God put her in my life. And I'm saying, God, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, Bob, you wouldn't believe it. God put this woman in my life, and this is why. And this friend of my first sponsor's heard me saying that, jumped right into the conversation, said, hey, Carl, God's not a pimp. It's like, that was bad news. But anyway, so we're dating. And I don't know, and she's 4 years sober, and she is getting her master's degree in psychology. She might have been dating me just to do a paper on, you know, abnormal behavior, might be. But anyway, I don't know, when you're dating, quite often the conversation comes up as to when you lost your virginity. So she told me when she lost hers, and I told her when I lost mine. I told her that when I was 12 years old, this college girl, my parents had taken off for a couple of weeks, and this college girl was asked to watch our house, and she had, she looks at me and she goes, oh my God, you were molested as a child if that happened at 12. And I went, you're kidding. I didn't feel like I'd been molested. She goes, no, I've been studying all about this in class. You are going to have all sorts of trouble in your life if you don't address this. And now I just go, oh, my God, I'm just trying to stay sober here, and now this. And so I'm, like, all upset, and I'm at the meeting the very next day, and I can't get this off my mind. I'm just, oh, my God, I was molested as a child. I never knew this. And in San Diego, it's always podium participation, right? They don't let you share from your seat. You go up to the podium, and it's a big meeting. And I'm sitting there, and I'm just, and for whatever reason, the guy leading the meeting says, hey, how about you? Points right at me. And I go, what? So I walk up there, and I go, I'm really in a bad place today. The girl I'm dating told me that I was molested as a child because this house sitter, and then I start to, as I'm telling the story, I just went, oh, because it hit me like a ton of bricks. That never happened. It was a lie. When I was 15, my best friend Dave got laid, so I had to make up a story. I couldn't be like... So I had made up a story, and I had told it so many times that I now believed it. And I thought this was a bad time to have this revelation. As I was standing up in front of about 200 people, I went, I'm sorry, that's a lie. And I sat down. And they all did, ha, 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 ha. And I'm sitting there in my chair, and I had one of those experiences where you're just sort of like, because what else in my life is a lie? What else is a lie? Right? And if I would have had to have been completely aware and honest with myself in all areas in order to stay sober, I'm now in trouble. But it's not true. Based upon my experience and working with hundreds and hundreds of other men and my life and talking with my friends, it's a long road in getting honest with other on other things. And really the only reason that I really try to practice rigorously honesty across the board is because I don't want to have to make the amends, right? Here's a good example. I had to talk somewhere in Nebraska, and I was at a gas station, and I paid with a 20. The guy gave me change for 100 for some reason. Sweet, right? Very nice. But I immediately said, can't do that. Here, I only gave you a 20. And he was very grateful. Wow. And I didn't do that because I'm a good guy. I did that because in order to make amends for that, I was going to have to buy a plane ticket back to Nebraska. That's very expensive. Then if I were able to find the guy and he didn't have, if he'd lost his job, now I owe some serious amends. I got to like help with his unemployment. Right? So that's the reason I really try that. So their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. What they're talking about now here is what is currently inside of Alcoholics Anonymous called duly diagnosed, who have a mental issue along with, no, not the mental issue you have, right? where they have a clinical diagnosis with an emotional disorder along with alcoholism, drug addiction, that's what they're talking about. They're not talking, when they say duly diagnosed, they're not talking about, I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. No, no, no. They're talking about that other thing, right? There are people who are actually like that. Now, the problem is that there's a whole other population that thinks they're like that, but they're not. But there really are people that are like that. They can recover, too, if they have the capacity to be honest about their alcoholism. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, what we're like now. You ever wondered, boy, if I get called on, what do I say? What do I say? What do I say? Oh, my God, I got asked to talk for 10 minutes. What do I say? If you've been here for even 90 days, you have heard it 100 times. They tell us exactly how we're supposed to share in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. It doesn't matter whether we're sharing for 3 minutes or 45 minutes. It's very possible in 3 minutes to throw out two sentences about to get people to identify with that you are really alcoholic, and two sentences as to what happened that I wound up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and two sentences as what I'm trying to be like today. It's very possible to do that. And it's absolutely okay to say the same thing again and again and again. Because if you understand Alcoholics Anonymous, you're not sharing to impress your friends. You are sharing in that meeting talking to somebody you don't even know is there. I remember there was this one old-timer down in San Diego where I got sober. And I'm sitting at a meeting with my first sponsor, and the old-timer started saying the same thing he said 3 days ago. And I say to my first sponsor, Bob, I can't believe he's saying the same thing. How boring. He went like this, bam, he's not talking to you. He's talking to the person that apparently you're not even aware is here. The new person who's never heard it before. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Ever been in question and answer or book studies? Is there a timeline as to when I'm supposed to work the steps? Is one step a year okay? Right? You hear this type of stuff. Well, again, if you've been here for a year, you have heard it read to you over 100 times. maybe 200 times as to the timeline for working the steps. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. That does not matter whether you walked in the door 30 minutes ago or 3 years ago. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, now is the time to work the steps. Notice that it does not say, if your wife has decided you want what we have. Notice it does not say, if your probation officer has decided you want what we have. And notice that it doesn't even say, if your sponsor has decided you want what we have. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with a sponsor egging you and prodding you into working the steps. But it's my belief, based upon my experience, that for this thing to take hold the way it needs to, there is a level of willingness on your part that must be there. And that decision of you really want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it must be there. Some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. I was listening to chapter 5 for at least the 2,000th time when this one fellow was reading it. And I had one of those experiences that I described earlier. I had never heard that sentence in that way. And isn't it amazing the way the big book does that to us? We can have read the same page, the same chapter, the same line 1,000 times. And we're sitting there at some point, and all of a sudden the same line is read, and it's like, I have never heard it like that before. That's actually one of the two qualifications that makes the big book, by literary standards, a divinely inspired book. Did you know that? That the big book actually qualifies? There's literary experts say that there's two things that must be in place for a piece of literature to be classified as divinely inspired. First one, that the authors have the ability to be able to write such a piece of literature. Bill and the first 100 were all less than 3 years sober. Think about it. Think about the guy that you sponsor that is 3 years sober. Do you even give him the keys to your car? Maybe not. Let alone write a book. Let alone write that is going to probably stand up to history for the next how many millennium. Right? So, of course, the people that wrote this did not have the ability to write this piece of literature. Number two, does it speak to the population that reads it in a different way at different times in their life? Do the same words take on different meaning at different times of people's life? And the big book absolutely does that. I think you would agree. It absolutely fits those two criteria to be a divinely inspired book. It hit me like a ton of bricks when I heard somebody reading it. They were just nonchalantly reading that we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very with all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. And what I heard that day were the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous talking to me from their grave. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you. Think about that. They were begging me. Because they had, more than any of us, had seen a million failures in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous. People, because they barely understood it themselves, they had a very hard time communicating it. When they finally got the book, it got a lot easier. But I don't know how many hundreds, if not thousands, each one of those original members had seen. So they were begging us from their grave. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Did you know they even meant our good ideas? Did you know that even if, like me, my father was a Lutheran minister, and he actually was a very open-minded, worldly kind of guy who was not single-minded like most Scandinavian Lutheran ministers. He had a very wide open idea of God. And I was raised in a beautiful idea of God now that I look at it. Now, I paid no attention, right, at all. Didn't even know who my father was until I got sober, right? I had labeled him the enemy by the time I was 12. So I had a good idea of what God was. And I was being asked to even drop that, because apparently that is not sufficient enough to go up against alcoholism. Right? If even a good idea of God was just sufficient enough, then we would have no priests or pastors or rabbis in Alcoholics Anonymous, because their knowledge of God would be sufficient. And we all know it's not. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Again, I don't know about you, but I was very confused when I was new, because I always heard people talking about, well, my God, and you can borrow my, and oh, and some, well, my God, this, and they kept on describing what seemed to be different gods. And I thought, my God, is this pagan Rome? You know, I didn't understand that what they were actually saying was, there is one who has all power, that one is God, but you can have your perception of any way you want. In fact, it's the one thing that makes us not a religion. We can really look like a religion to a new person. New person sitting in the back, they could think, this is really, I mean, look at that. We're all sitting here all nice. They look like their chairs. They look like pews, though. And there's somebody up here holding this book, just like hellfire and brimstone. You're going to drink if you don't. Right? Up here at a podium like that, they're going, ooh, quite the minister there, huh? Right? And then, of course, the big one. Here comes the offering plate. They're passing the basket, right? It can really look like that to a brand new person. But the thing that makes us not a religion is that we do not define God in any way, shape, or form. Right? However you want to believe in this power greater than yourself, we just go, thumbs up. Absolutely. The most simple idea, even like it says in We Agnostics, we needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe in a power greater than myself? There's no dogma attached to that. There's no explanation of what you think God is. They're saying step two is simply, you believe or are even willing to believe? It says upon that simple cornerstone, a wonderfully spiritual structure can be built. It's been repeated, proven among us again and again. But I remember getting confused, and I thought I'd call my dad. He'd been a minister and a theologian. Everybody's talking about a different God, and I decided to call my dad. I go, I call up my father, and Dad, you've been a minister and a theologian for 40 years. You spent your whole life studying about, talking about, living your life for God. Please, tell me what God is. So I'm thinking he's going to tell me I'm going to come straighten out the people in AA, right? And again, there was just a couple of seconds of silence, and my dad said, Carl, how long has it been since you've had a drink? And I said, 5 months. He said, well then, God is whatever got you to those people in AA. For Christ's sake, do what they say. Click. Half measure availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrong. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Ten, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. When they say no one, that means absolutely no one. Larsine, you? Anybody maintain perfect adherence? Butch? Tim? Kelly? Chip? No. No one has been able to maintain anything like. That means not even frickin' close. Did you know that? So we need to quit judging each other. Extremely damaging to a home group. When you're pointing out things that are going on in people's lives, things people are struggling with, absolutely detrimental to the home group. This is the way I like to look at it, when, because I've been part of a situation where harming the home group because I was arguing with a guy, and I sponsored a lot of guys, and he sponsored guys. He was also had a big company. He had a lot of guys working for him, and we got in a big, for a couple of years, and we fought openly, and we took sides. He even went and started his own AA club, called it The Other Club, right? But when a home group is doing that, the best way to describe it is, it's kind of like back in the when the English, now calling themselves Americans, were taking over the West, and the Indians were losing their land little by little by little, but yet they still fought amongst each other. And it's kind of like the Navajos and the Apaches out there on the Great Plains having a war amongst themselves, and up there on the big plateau, there's a scout. He's got a telescope. He's got a giant army coming up behind him. And he's down there looking at the Navajos and the Apaches fighting amongst themselves, and says to the other scout with him, "Why are they fighting each other when we're here?" And that's the way alcohol stands and looks at the home group as we're fighting amongst ourselves, and says, "Why are they fighting each other when I'm here?" Got to think about that in the struggles you're having in your home group. You must work out whatever is going on in your home group. Petty squabbles have to be laughed aside. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. What they're saying is, by the time you get here to this part of the book, this paragraph, we assume that you have read everything prior to it, and it has our description of the alcoholic, which is everything up to we agnostics. Everything in the book up to we agnostics is the book's description of the alcoholic. So they're assuming you have read that. Two, they believe that you have read the chapter to the agnostic. And they also are hoping that you have read some of the personal adventures. And that's in those days, that you've gone into the back of the book and read enough stories for you to have identified. In these days, we're also hoping you've been to enough meetings, preferably a number of speaker meetings, where you have heard people tell their full story and you have identified. And they're hoping that these three things are in place. You've read the book's description of the alcoholic. You have read the chapter to the agnostic. You have heard enough other stories in Alcoholics Anonymous, either by reading or listening. And if you have those three things in place, they are assuming that there are three very pertinent ideas that you have. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. Have a great afternoon and a good dinner. Thanks.